Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hey, I'm Nancy Wilson.
Mike Campbell. Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Hey, it's Adam from Counting Crows, and I am here giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back for season 4. I'm Peter Chatti of Deep Cuts Media, and this season we're diving even deeper into some of music history's most iconic tracks with the legends who made them.
What's so beautiful about it is a lot of people connect with, you gotta live your life and don't let the big man push you down. Don't have to live like a refugee, can't keep fighting for what you believe. And that was Tom.
From the spark of inspiration to untold tales from the studio, we unlock the true stories that shape the music you love.
At the time on the radio, there was a really cool riff by Nazareth covering a Joni Mitchell song, This Flight Tonight. It had the same groove, but I think Barracuda kind of blew it out of the water.
Join us as we all sit down with music icons like Devo, Heart, Mike Campbell of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Sublime, Counting Crows, and so many more. New episodes are out now from the Consequence Podcast Network, so tune in wherever you get your podcasts and join me for the story behind the song.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
The music world moves fast. Want to stay up to date on the latest albums and get in-depth examinations with the artists? Check out Consequence of Sound, the podcast. Bite-sized album reviews for the music fan on the go who wants to stay in the know, and much more. Subscribe to the series on iTunes or your favorite podcast provider, and let the writers of Consequence of Sound steer you right. Check it out at consequenceofsound.net/COS podcast. Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with an audio interview series presented by WFPK Independent Louisville at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound and the Consequence Podcast Network. Wherever you're listening from right now, I hope you subscribe to the series, whether you're listening on Spotify, on YouTube, or iTunes and Apple Podcasts, really wherever you get your favorite podcast from. You can subscribe as we put out interviews every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday over at Consequence of Sound, and we'd love to keep you up to date on all of those. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest, Ed Kowalczyk of the band Live. It is the 25th anniversary of their breakthrough album, Throwing Copper. This is the one with Lightning Crashes, I Alone, Selling the Drama, White Discussion all over you. And honestly, it just keeps going down. They're releasing the anniversary edition, and we're going to talk about all of that, the history behind this record here, what it was like recording it, what the whole environment was like around the band at the time, and get some of the stories behind the songs, like Lightning Crashes and Stage, and the new songs. Well, the new songs that were recorded then and just unreleased until now. Hold Me Up, We Sell in Dreams, and Susquehanna. It's also a bonus disc on this anniversary edition that includes their 94 set from Woodstock. And if you're a listener to the series, you know I like to talk about the Woodstock shows. Not only will we get a bit of the behind the scenes on Woodstock 94, but Live also played 99. It was a very different scene. And this whole anniversary run actually comes as the band reformed. They had split up. The rest of the guys had recruited a different singer and released an album in there called The Turn. I'm also going to ask about that one. But as well as their proper reunion EP that came out last year, the Local 717, that shows the guys in top songwriting form. And Ed will give us a little bit of insight on what's to come. There will be new music. There will be more new music. The band is currently on tour with Bush and Our Lady Peace. That is a huge package. We're going to talk about that. But first, as you'll hear in just a moment, we're going to start back in 1989. Because even though this is the 25th anniversary of Throwing Copper, it's actually the 30th anniversary of their very first record, which they had a different name at that time. It's Kyle Meredith with Ed Kowalczyk of Live.
Hey, Kyle. It's Ed Kowalczyk of Live calling.
Well, I know, first off, we're talking about the upcoming tour, and this is all revolving around the 25th anniversary of Throwing Copper. But I did want to take the quick moment before that because actually, sort of Live's very first album, Death of a Dictionary, is 30 years old. So I don't think a lot of people, and honestly, I've been a fan of you all since Mental Jewelry, and I was not aware that Live actually traces all the way back to like the early 80s and 84. Like, that's a long time to be around as a band.
It is a long time. You know, we started this band. My name's Chad Taylor since we were in kindergarten. We both went to Devers Elementary School in York, Pennsylvania. And then I met the rest of the guys. We all met, the four of us, in junior high school. And so we started the band in the summer before we went into high school. I want to say that was 84, 85. And then we all graduated in 89. And we called the band Public Affection back then in high school. We were kind of like a hybrid new wave cover band doing our own songs kind of thing in high school. And we actually, we sold junk bonds to our relatives and raised some money and made that Death of the Dictionary cassette, actually. It only came out on cassette, so that tells you
right
about those days in terms of... It was later than the 8-track. Yeah, there were no 8-track. They're not that old. But that recording, you know, really got out there, and then that kind of led to our record deal, which then, of course, Mental Jewelry was 19. Well, the EP that... There was a 4-song EP that preceded Mental Jewelry. That was 1991. Yeah, it's been a while.
I mean, seriously, and you know, I've said this about other bands too, but you know, for a band to stick around 7 years seems like an accomplishment, but to take it all the way back there, I mean, it's over 30 years, and that's incredible. I mean, congratulations. I know it's not been an entirely straight line the entire way, but here we are, and we're celebrating still. So
it really is. That's exactly right. The perfect word for it, celebration right now. I mean, like you said, it was not a straight line, but there's a lot of beauty in it now that we see from the perspective that we have now on stage. Just we're happy for all of the ups and downs, because whatever got us here, we'll take it.
You mentioned, you know, Death of a Dictionary only coming out on cassette, long out of print. Is that something you all will ever mess with, or is that left to the past?
Well, we'll see. You know, I mean, fans would love it. So I think so at some point, just because, you know, there's just a tinge of sadness every time I read a little, like a comment about, you know, I could only find it on eBay from, you know, somebody from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, right. You know, had like three of them, you know, that kind of thing. So we will, we've been having a lot of fun doing that the last couple of years since we got back together. You know, we celebrated the 25th anniversary of Mental Jewelry, and we did a cool vinyl, and we did some different things for that. And then, of course, this one for Throwing Copper was really fun. We had three unreleased tracks from that record that we've included on this anniversary edition, which were actually recorded during the Throwing Copper sessions, but just didn't make the CD. So it's really just for length, you know, reasons. It was just, we just had too many songs and had to whittle it down to 14 and end up leaving these three off that are just as good, I think, as anything on the album. And then we also mixed and mastered our 1994 Woodstock performance as the other disc, or vinyl or whatever, whichever one you get. So it's been great because just, you know, we're doing, of course, we're doing new music as well and celebrating that. And we're, of course, doing shows. But then to be able to go back into the vault and, like, really have some fun sort of with these time capsules has been, it's been really fun.
You hit on some stuff I definitely want to hit on later, too. But kind of going into Throwing Copper then, you had success with Operation Spirits on Mental Jewelry. Was there a moment that you remembered when you noticed that Throwing Copper was going to be so much bigger than that?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because with Mental Jewelry, we felt like, you know, we felt so good about where we were able to take the band at that point. You know, we were, we'd make a bunch of videos that were on MTV. We, you know, we got on, as far as I was concerned, we got on 120 minutes, you know, we got on the CMJ chart. You know, for me, it was like, okay, what else?
Right,
you know,
that's it. Sure.
You know,
right.
That's where all my heroes were there. I was there, you know, so I felt like in a lot of ways we had achieved so much, but then, you know, there was this blank slate between, you know, Mental Jewelry and Throwing Copper, and the record company's really excited about everything we had going, but we had no songs. I mean, we were just, you know, like I said, at this blank slate kind of place. And I remember Chad and I got together and we started to mess around with guitar tones for the first time. We never really focused too much on what the guitars sounded like. And of course we were getting lots of that influence of that era as well, you know, and with big guitars and big dynamics. And I was, you know, fledgling as a songwriter, as a lyricist. And it's just, there was a magical moment where, you know, it just started to come together. Our sound, you know, we found this dynamic that really fit my lyrics and really fit these big songs and these big ideas. And I remember listening to, rewind a little bit. We recorded Throwing Copper at Pachyderm Studios, which had just been within that year or two, was where Nirvana did In Utero. And it was just this amazing household studio in the middle of the woods in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. So it was really a special time. And I remember getting the final mixes and listening in my car and just thinking, this is great. Like, we really made an album. We really made this piece that works together so well. And I remember, you know, having my favorite songs and just everybody being really, really excited. But, you know, fast forward a year before that, we didn't know what we were going to do after Mental Jewelry, really.
So once it happens, though, I mean, you know, Selling the Drama comes out, which by the way, that opening lick right there is like a pillar of my youth anytime I hear that and your voice coming in. Yeah. And then there your voice is. And you know, 25 years later, I can still feel every moment of that in the way that music lets us time travel, you know, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I know Selling the Drama, it comes out and then the singles start to roll out and then it just seems to steamroll. Did it ever get to a point then where it felt out of control?
Oh, we were definitely, you know, riding the bull there, trying to hang on for, you know, a solid year and a half. I think that, again, our perspective was that we, you know, had our goals were to get it out, you know, at college radio, go, you know, be able to tour, you know, maybe get some, you know, bigger radio play with alternative radio. But we were just focused on doing great shows and sort of just had our head down, you know, so intensely to get the band going that the album came out. You mentioned Selling the Drama. And then I Alone came out after that. And then that kind of just, you know, we really kind of hit, I wouldn't say a plateau, but we definitely hit a place where, like, okay, people know who the band is. We're doing these great tours. And then we got the, you know, the message from the powers that be at that time that Lightning Crashes would be the next single. And I was really excited about that because I did not expect it. In fact, I was told by the record company that that would never be a single, even though I'd said it was my favorite, you know, I really loved it. They said, no way, it's 5.5 minutes long. It'll never be a single. It takes too long to get to the chorus. And I said, okay, I kind of resigned myself to that. So when I got that call that they were going to put that song out, I was just super excited for the fans and for the band because I felt like if that song in particular had a depth and something very special about it. And after that came out, then it was Saturday Night Live and Rolling Stone and the cover of Rolling Stone all within like 2 months and all this crazy stuff started having number one records. And it was really Lightning Crashes that where it felt to be like, okay, now this is a whole different thing, like, than what we were expecting. We're just going to go with it and figure out really how to be a band in these big venues. The venues got so big so fast that we had a lot of learning to do.
You take a song like that, like Lightning Crashes, and it seemed like everybody, especially because of that video, it became an instant debate about what the song was about. And I thought,
right,
you know, spirituality was such a strong part of your writing from the beginning, it seems like. But it also sounds like it's something that you constantly had to explain. Was that the case?
You know, I resist that. I did then and I do now only because, you know, I've always written lyrics in these sort of like, you know, I'll take these sort of little blitz and blurbs and I'll put together these more like montages of meaning throughout a whole song. I never really sit down with a concept of like, okay, this is what it's, this is the story I'm telling, or this is exactly what I want everybody to get from it. I mean, I might have my own feelings about it, but I've never really paid much attention to that in terms of how people consume it and what they, how they interpret it. I just, you know, I knew it was a beautiful song and I knew that it left me feeling really good. And I figured, well, I'll stay out of the way, you know, with what I think and let people just absorb this and take it in and consume it how they want to. And it's been a beautiful thing to watch with that approach over the years and how well it's aged, because it's still so interesting to people. There's this meditative aspect to that song and a lot of our songs that people really do drop out and make it their own and take it in all kinds of different ways. As a writer, it really doesn't get any better than that to watch that. Something so simple as a simple idea and a simple song to have that kind of impact and still, you know, mean so much to people.
So with the success of a song like that, you didn't feel any sense of overprotectiveness to the song itself?
Well, you know, I didn't. And I think right away, you know, we were a big band in our own minds right away. We were trying to take these, especially in our school years, our heroes were these guys that had their hearts right out there. You know, U2, mm-hmm. Early R.E.M., well, R.E.M. in general. You know, those were our heroes. So I always felt like that's what you did. You know, you just went as deep as you can in yourself and you just pour it all out. And people say, oh, it's too earnest, it's this and that. Oh, well, I'll take those bruises, because the payoff is this incredible relationship with people that became worldwide really quickly.
Well, it's just incredible songs. I mean, and it's still incredible songs. I do want to ask you about another one of them, too, because you mentioned Nirvana a minute ago. I never knew it until reading. Yeah. Was the song Stage about Kurt and Courtney, as I've read?
No, not in particular. That's an interesting interpretation. I haven't heard that one yet. I'll have to go back and listen to the lyric now and see how that kind of pointed that way. But not in my mind, not consciously, no.
It says, I read that in two different spots that got that mentioned. They didn't mention it in the same way, though, which is why I questioned it.
Well, I think that song, and you know, selling the drama stage, you know, there was, when I go back and now of course we're celebrating that record and playing these songs all the time, I think about, you know, that era and there was this sort of like internal battle, it seems, that every, you know, a lot of singer-songwriters and bands were going through at that time, which was, okay, corporate rock sucks. We want our bands to do well, but we don't want to be Bon Jovi. You know, we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to. So there was this constant kind of like tension between the super private, personal, spiritual music that was being made, not just by us, but tons of bands at that time, and the business and how, you know, what was the coolest way to, and the most sincere way to express that. And the beautiful thing about that time was it was wide open. You know, I mean, we had these amazing videos that we had total control over. And it was really amazing to have that freedom at that time. You know, people would really kind of say, okay, this was an era of the individual in a sense, in that we were able to, like I said, have that freedom and have that capacity to put out really whatever we want.
The moment when rock actually did rule the world, when you could listen to the top 40 pop stations and there it was, you know. Well, not including, you know, a hidden track on there, the album does wrap up with just this amazing song, one of my all-time favorites, with White Discussion. And now as I listen to it, I'm such a huge fan, especially of the follow-up record with Secret Samadhi. White Discussion, now when I listen to it, it seems like the bridge to that album. It's like you could put the two albums on next to each other, and that song, aurally, to me at least, it seems to carry it straight into it.
Oh, certainly. For sure, yeah. There's definitely, you know, an arc there between a few songs on Throwing Copper and then Secret Samadhi. If anything, that just went into a more kind of mysterious, dark kind of place in general in that record. But yeah, there's definitely inklings of it, of that arc in Throwing Copper, that you can see where we were headed. Just getting more and more and more into guitar tones and the dynamics of that and how to use that. And that's a lot, you know, Chad Taylor, our guitar player, he went really like mental with guitars. Like it was like a light switch went off. He just like flicked it, and all of a sudden it was like there were 50 amps in the studio. It was like, what the hell happened? You know, what are we doing? You know, and I it's funny, I talk about Nirvana, I talk about those, but I was, you know, I'm always remiss, I think, to not mention Bob Mould and Sugar and Dinosaur Jr. And there were just some such amazing guitar bands, like guitar records that were so fun and so interesting going on at that time that we just were soaking it all in.
So we got the anniversary edition and a few of these new songs that you were talking about. So two of these, so We Deal in Dreams, that was the first one, I believe, that we heard, because that came out on the Greatest Hits, right?
Yes, it did. So we're, you know, these songs, I believe just We Deal in Dreams on the Greatest Hits. There's a song called Susquehanna that is officially, this is the first time it's been out. And then Hold Me Up was in a movie, but it wasn't on the soundtrack. So it wasn't technically available for anybody to, like, have a good copy of it to listen to. It was just in the movie. It was in a movie called Zack and Mary Make a Porno.
Yeah, the Kevin Smith movie, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is the first time that they've been, those three songs have been, like, available, like, in one place that's connected to Throwing Copper and, you know, available in a good way.
It's just amazing, the quality of these songs. I mean, you've said it before. Hold Me Up could have been a single, and I've read the story of Kevin Smith chasing you down for years trying to get this song the rights because it was so good. I mean, it says everything about this record that a song like that wasn't included.
Yeah, it was we were in the zone there. I mean, there was definitely a good supply of that pixie dust, as they say, you know, in terms of just one song after the other, just having this really unique signature, but yet all working together and tying together. And yeah, I remember having that conversation with our record company guy. Well, the man who really did so much for our career early on was a guy named Gary Kerfurst, who he was a mega manager throughout the 80s with the Ramones and Talking Heads and Debbie Harry. And, and he started a record label called Radioactive. And that was our label. And I remember, you know, I had so much back and forth with him in the beginning, especially in his first two albums. And I remember him saying, this is just amazing that we can leave this song off. And I said, you know, I remember saying, should we leave it off? And he said, yeah, there's always room. We'll find somewhere to, it'll come out someday. Who knows, you know? And it's exciting. It was exciting to be able to do that. And now, you know, fast forward all these years, you know, it's I keep calling it like a time capsule. It's just like, wow, look at that. Look what's in there, you know? Yeah.
Woodstock being the other, I, of course, love the set. And I think Selling the Drama had come out on the Woodstock 94 soundtrack. I've talked to a lot of artists about this. You're one of the few that did play two Woodstocks with 94 and 99. And I'd love to get some stories about what comes to mind on those two shows. What do you remember about those?
You know, looking back on it now, it was an exciting time. It was an exciting show. It was a humongous crowd. It was exciting that we were part of this, what seemed to be a historical thing with this redo of or celebration of Woodstock. So that was, it's all happening in the moment, and it was amazing. But now I look back and I was like, wow, that really did, you know, that really did come about 3 months before the band was like all of a sudden everywhere.
Yeah.
And in no small way is it due to the fact that we played in front of, you know, we did a really great set, short set in front of what, I don't know, 300,000 people or something.
Right.
It's an astronomical size of a crowd. So yeah, looking back, I think, wow, that really was kind of like a singular moment that year. Of course, the following year, you know, we were just off to the races, but that was, that was a watershed for sure.
And then, of course, you end up at 99, and I've heard, you know, several artists who did play the bill had a very different experience. I mean, we know history paints that, but it seems like the artists sort of had that same experience that we see in the history books.
Absolutely, yeah. I remember, well, we played Friday night, and all the sort of mayhem went down the day after, and we were long gone to another show, and we couldn't believe it. We were like, what happened? It started out okay. It was fine on Friday, and then all of a sudden by Saturday, it was like not fine, you know? But I do remember showing up to the site and thinking, this is weird. Mm-hmm. Like, it's super hot. It's just a bunch of concrete. It's this old Air Force base or something. And I remember thinking, this doesn't feel like Woodstocky to me. You know, this feels a little off. But that was just a sense I had. Well, we'll go play the show, play our set. We're out of there, you know, Friday night. And then that sort of feeling that I had, and I think that was, like you said, kind of permeated there was something a little bit off about it. And then history now that Saturday rolled around, it was full blown.
It's interesting, on the soundtrack that did come out, they used I Alone, and there you are. You've got the whole crowd chanting the word love over and over in this magical moment, and that love disappeared. That love was...
It just went, it went bye-bye real quick. But that's the thing about 94, you know, when I look back on 94 now, 94 really felt like that was a really special group of bands, and the lineup, I mean, it's just out of this world. And I think that, you know, if you could take, you know, okay, you say the, you know, Woodstock, and you go, okay, well, we obviously know the incredible importance and awesomeness of the first one. You take the brand, you put it on a new show, you go, okay, I get it. It's, you know, we're doing it over again, and it's more of a, you know, a brand now that everybody knows. And but now I go, wow, there really was a sense that it kind of bookended a real renaissance in rock and roll. That when you can go back now and watch the entire thing, it's pretty amazing. So yeah, I feel from this perspective, like much more, like it feels much more important now than I remember it feeling. It was just like, not that it wasn't amazing, it wasn't exciting, but as we've gained some years here, it truly stands out.
I do want to pull it more into the present day. Live put out an EP last year with a local 717, and I'm hoping that's just a precursor that we're restarted here and everything is go for the next round. Is that kind of a teaser of what's to come?
Yeah, absolutely. We started writing music almost right away when we got back together 3 or 4 years ago now, which really surprised everybody. You know, we were surprised that we got back together at all. The fact that we were writing music so quickly meant that, you know, the relationship was intact and we felt comfortable enough, you know, again, to do that and get into that process. So that's been in the background of the whole entire reunion, even though we've only put out, you know, the one EP. There's been constant efforts at recording in our studio in New York. So we're hoping after this ultimate tour wraps up, I think it's going to go into October now, that we'll get back in the studio late this year and then into next year. And then next year, of course, we'll definitely be putting out new music. I'm not sure if it'll be an EP right away. Chad and I have been toying with the idea of, you know, getting into the sort of 45 aspect or just doing two songs and having an A and B side, and then wait until we have more of those to put together as an album, just so we don't wait and the fans don't wait. So I'm hoping we can, who knows, maybe we'll even write on the road.
Yeah.
I never know if that's going to work, but yes, new music, long story short, new music for sure. That's a big part of how we feel, like, you know, it legitimizes us and in our own sense of what it means to be a band, that it's not just going out and playing shows. The shows are great, but if you're not creating, it just feels off. It feels like there's a big piece missing, even if it's not coming out right away. It's just part of that process that just is so important to our relationship as a band.
I'll only ask a bit awkwardly here. Does the album The Turn have a place in your catalog, or is that sort of something else?
Nope. Honestly, never even listened to it. And when we got back together, we decided that, you know, hey, this is the original. And we're going to rearrange the discography to reflect the fact that the original band's back. And yes, so no, that's not part of it anymore.
Right. So and I'll conclude with, so we got the tour. You're on tour with Bush. I just had Gavin on the show the other day, too. So I'm actually glad to kind of both sides of this, too, because here you are, both two behemoth alternative bands celebrating, you know, huge albums. I mean, this tour, which I think you've already started on, right? I mean, it sounds like a monster.
Yeah, we did. We did 7 shows and they were absolutely amazing. I mean, this last one we played Saturday night at the PNC Center in Homedale, New Jersey was, I mean, just packed to the gills, and it was this incredible energy from the fans that I saw Gavin after the show, and we were both just like, yeah, we're off for the races now. We're really feeling like this package is so strong for the fans, and they're loving it.
Well, I hope to catch one of these dates and Our Lady Peace on there as well, which I'm a fan of. So
yes.
Yeah.
Great band. Really great band.
Ed, this has been such an honor and so much fun for me. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about
you.
This today.
Appreciate it.
And I look forward to the new music, man. I love the EP. I can't wait to hear what's next.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right, dude. Take care.
Take care, man. You too, bud. Bye-bye.
A huge thanks. Ed Kowalczyk of the band Live, currently on tour with Bush and Our Lady Peace, the 25th anniversary edition of Throwing Copper, and their latest new music, the Local 717 EP that came out late 2018. And remember, before you get out of here, there is a subscribe button in front of you that I hope you hit to stay up to date on this series. Interviews out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can, of course, subscribe anywhere you get your favorite podcast from, like iTunes, Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or even on YouTube. After that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Friday, where you can also find some bonus episodes of this series. ConsequenceOfSound.net has your music and film news. You can find me also at Twitter at Kyle Meredith and Facebook/Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith. I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.